This podcast is brought to you by ThrottleNet. ThrottleNet can provide world-class managed IT services and IT support to your business. They're St. Louis's highest-rated outsourced IT company, and there's many different ways ThrottleNet can help with your business's operation and digital protection. Check them out at ThrottleNet.com.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewsTalkSTL.com.
Every day narrows down. This is why I went on February 1st to see the president. I asked him that we could sit down. We can't get those 97 days back that he said he would never negotiate. We've only been able to negotiate for the last couple of weeks. We know it's a crunch time. We know it's not easy. But we're going to make sure we're not just trying to get an agreement. We're trying to get something that's worthy of the American people that changes the trajectory. So we're going to work just as hard. We worked through the night last night. I thought we made progress yesterday. I want to make progress again today, and I want to be able to solve this problem.
Happy Friday, and welcome into the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. My partner, Tim Jones, is out today. His birthday was yesterday, and so I think he's taking an extra day off today, and the holiday is on Monday. So rest well, my friend, and happy birthday once again. Joining us in the studio, he is setting a record today,
Doing
every live show. You know that voice, Gabe Pfeiffer from the morning show, Mike Ferguson in the morning. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing great. Great to be here. I did it, folks. I'm hitting for the cycle.
You're looking a little sleepy there. How many 5-hour energy drinks have you had?
Not enough.
You know, I'm glad that you're here, Gabe. You know, one of the big news today, of course, is a possible budget agreement. The deadline is coming up Wednesday. We'll talk about that during the rest of the show. But I want to get your thoughts on the DeSantis rollout from the other day. I didn't get a chance to listen to you guys in the morning. So, what's your thoughts, Monday morning quarterback?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a little bit of the suggestion that it was an absolute debacle. I mean, on some level, obviously, you know, there's a bit of a stumble there, but I think the declarations that it was, you know, disastrous, I think, were a little overblown, just because we're dealing with kind of new territory with him doing this. It's very much in line with Obama becoming kind of the first social media president during his campaign. Bill Clinton going on with Arsenio, I think, was one of those seminal moments where it's just like, we're doing something different here. Mm-hmm. And I think rolling out with basically a sit down conversation, first of all, podcast style, and via a sort of Twitter live audio broadcast, I think was a very different thing. I think it's very much in line with what a lot of people are doing these days, where they just listen to something like a Joe Rogan, they pop it in their ears for a few hours, and they're just fine listening to long form conversations like that. So, technical difficulties notwithstanding, I think it actually turned out to be pretty successful. And if the numbers that are on the link that I think Elon Musk posted for that thing are right, millions of people have tuned into that podcast.
Over 3 million.
Yeah, whether or not it was, you know, at the time, but certainly over the next the day or so, yeah, 3 million people tuning in. I think that's a win.
I tell you, one way that you gauge if an event is successful is the amount of money that is raised. Mm. And DeSantis raised a staggering amount of money after his rollout. $8.2 million was raised in the first 24 hours. Ooh. They raised $1 million a month. So yeah, they stumbled out of the block a little bit when it came to the rollout. But if you look at in terms of money, what does that say to you, Gabe, and you, Katie?
Can I ask you quickly first?
Sure.
Chris, you've worked on many, many campaigns. This is, it's a lot of money. This is an impressive amount of money to you.
It's a record.
Okay, that's like from your expertise working on these campaigns and helping raise money, helping raise awareness. This is like, wow, cannot believe it kind of situation.
Well,
I'll give you
something to measure it by. At the beginning of the quarter, I think in March, Donald Trump's campaign had $14 million cash on hand. Ron DeSantis raised half of that in 24 hours.
Incredible.
So wow.
Incredible.
So, oh my gosh.
That's incredible.
So when you put it like that, it's like, oh, dang. So, okay.
One day.
So that
wow.
is the gauge of it. A lot of excitement. Now, stories said that they had people at the Ritz-Carlton down in Florida were dialing for dollars. Mm. They were calling it a Ronathon. basically.
Oh, man.
So,
I love that.
I'm sure that helped as well.
Mm-hmm.
They said they're going to get him out on the road. I think he's traveling to three or four different swing states, important states, and he's going to the all-important state, Gabe, of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Again, as far as I'm understanding here, I'm pretty sure he's been swinging by there every few weeks, it feels like. You know, it's like all of a sudden, Ron DeSantis, this is obviously prior to him announcing, like, oh, Ron DeSantis is in Iowa again. He's just selling his book, though. He's just selling, relax.
Yeah, just
selling it. Relax, guys. He's just going to talk to some people, no big.
You know, there's a lot more 2024 talk I want to get into with you, Gabe, but before I do that, I want to tell you who we have coming up as guests. Yes, we've got a really packed, good show on this Friday. Coming up at 4:24, we'll talk with Zach Smith, our legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. 5:07, Mitch Baden, President and Chief Executive Officer at Royal Banks of Missouri. We'll talk to him about the potential banking crisis. Is the banking system safe? And where should you be putting your money now in case with the government possibly defaulting? You know, government bonds, the place to go. Usually that's one of the safest places there is. And then at 5:24, Dr. Aaron Hudlin, chief economist at the Show Me Institute and former White House chief domestic economist. We'll talk to him about all things economics today. Had some numbers come out, inflation, the real inflation. I didn't see that number. Did you see that number, Dave, or Gabe?
No, I haven't seen anything yet on what those things are doing. I'm wondering what, if anything, the deal, the debt ceiling deal, is going to do to the market. That's the one that I'm actually more interested in. And from what I can tell, the market though has kind of recovered from its initial panics about the deadline looming. They seem to be a little more confident that a deal is going to get worked out.
Here's the thing that I don't understand, and I'm going to ask Mitch Baden, CEO of Royal Banks, when he comes on. Look. The markets and ordinary Americans and businesses are jittery now because the United States is reaching its debt limit, and technically, mm-hmm. we could default on those bonds, and those people will not get paid, bondholders will not be paid until Congress comes to some type of agreement, passes it, and then magically everything is okay. But before that's what I don't understand. It's like,
right,
why is everyone freaking about the United States defaulting on its debt when we know eventually some type of agreement is going to happen and then everything's going to be quote unquote back to normal? I don't understand that.
You know, that's a good question, especially when you consider too that it's not as though the government isn't going to be receiving funds constantly.
Yeah.
You know, and even though from a budgetary standpoint, you know, let's say $15 billion or whatever is set aside for some program, it's not all at once. It's not being siphoned from the coffers all at once. And some of these programs are very much dependent on circumstances. So, you know, like all of the money that's set aside for some of the grants that I could look up right now on like grants.gov mm-hmm. or what have you. It says, you know, $50 million available for some sort of housing program. That doesn't mean they took $50 million out of right. the treasury and it's sitting someplace. That means if someone meets a certain criteria, they may be eligible, might possibly, maybe sometime in the future, be eligible for up to $50 million. So when you add all those things up, all those little programs and all the timing and stuff, it doesn't seem to me as though we simply just run out of money. It's like, oh no, what are we going to do? I don't think that's actually going to happen. So I am wondering, like you are, what does it mean to quote unquote default on the debt?
Because they could pass something 5 minutes later and the
Magic.
Markets would be okay.
Yeah.
Okay. They've done something.
Everybody's
why?
Happy.
Yeah. you know, you guys are news junkies like I am. You follow this stuff very closely. Did you guys know there is a new Republican entrant into the presidential primary race?
Who did?
Really?
You guys didn't know?
Somebody?
Yeah, we've got a new entrant in the race.
Okay.
You may want to check him out, Gabe.
Okay.
He is the governor of North Dakota.
Wait, what?
Who? his name is Doug Burgum. And he is, according to the Wall Street Journal, he is poised to enter the GOP presidential race. Apparently, he is a wealthy former software entrepreneur.
Okay.
Got wealthy, went out to North Dakota, bought 70,000 acres of land.
Hey.
Got bored.
That sounds like the life, though.
Got bored and is like, you know, I think I'll run for governor. And of bought the seat. And
of course, it's North Dakota, so yeah, you could buy that seat.
Exactly.
Pretty much.
So yeah, and another participant, Katie, you were out this day.
Okay.
And Tim was out also. But a guy that's getting a lot of talk was... what is his name? Suarez. Francis Suarez. He is the mayor of Miami.
Oh.
And Miami is really booming. They have the lowest crime rate since 1964. Their housing is just going gangbusters. Kathy Ann Conway, I think I got it correctly, Trump's old campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, got in contact with him. He's been doing a lot of media. He said he's potentially looking at throwing his hat in the ring. Now, I think this is more of a vice presidential thing.
Yeah, I guess.
More than anything. But... And there's always a but.
But,
yeah.
Big but.
Somebody threw a wet blanket on that potential career aspiration for Suarez. According to the Miami Herald, quote, a developer quietly paid Miami Mayor Francis Suarez at least $170,000 over the past 2 years to help cut through red tape and secure critical permits for his stalled real estate project in Coconut Grove, according to internal corporate records exclusively obtained by the Miami Herald. Now, here's the kicker here. Suarez spokeswoman said, quote, she called the internal records characterization of Suarez's role inaccurate. So
wait a minute.
So she's not saying it didn't happen. it's like the way that you're characterizing it is not right.
Like,
it's inaccurate.
It didn't happen that way. Okay. Okay. Listen. What happened?
What happened?
I went to the bank and I got a savings account and a checking account. And when I put things in my checking account, I can't put it in the savings account. I can't move it over to my checking account. So what happened?
Yeah, no.
I don't think that's gonna work. Yeah. I don't think you can jive dance your way around the court that way.
You know, I'm expecting, he categorically denies this did not happen.
That's
these
standard.
Are lies. Why are you swearing? It's like, they're inaccurate.
Some things are inaccurate.
You wrongly characterized my role in that particular action.
And, you know, one more 2024 presidential thing. Glenn Youngkin, governor of Virginia. Everyone was saying he's not going to run. He said that he's going to stay in Virginia.
As he should.
His name is now being thrown out once again that he may throw his hat in the ring.
I know that came out earlier
in the week. Now, I don't see that.
Way too early for him.
I don't see that because his main advisor, Jeff Rowe, is working for Ron DeSantis' Never Back Down PAC.
And
I can't see him also working for the PAC and working for Glenn Youngkin.
That's called a conflict of interest.
That's called breaking in a lot of money, too. That's what it's also called, too. Look, when we come back, we're going to speak with Zach Smith, our legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. I have a lot of questions about him. Supreme Court is coming close to the end of the term and giving out some some big decisions. We'll talk to him when we come back on the Tim Jones and Chris Sarb show with Gabe Pfeiffer, here setting a record here on News Talk STL on 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL. Jungle Room.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewsTalkSTL.com.
And welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp show on this Friday before the Memorial Day holiday weekend. And joining us, as he does every Friday, it's our legal eagle from the Heritage Foundation, Zach Smith.
Oh, it's all perfectly legal.
Zach Smith, legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation.
You know, I ask you a lot of predictions. Can you predict what the Supreme Court probably will do with this action? Zach, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing okay, Chris. How are you?
Good, good, good. I've got a couple of Supreme Court questions I'd like to ask you first before we dive into the other things. I want to congratulate you. A couple of weeks ago, I asked you about what do you think Harlan Crow's response would be to any type of action from the Congress asking him to hand over any notes or testify, and he has told them to pound sand, and you were correct on that. So, I congratulate you on that.
Well, thank you, Chris. Don't get used to it. You know, broken clock is right twice a day, I guess. But I think that was the response everyone expected to come down from Harlan Crow.
And I also want to ask you about this latest Supreme Court ruling that seems to be taking power away from the bureaucrats and giving it hopefully back to the legislative branch where it belongs with this recent EPA ruling. Those that haven't heard about it, what's going on with that?
Yeah, at first glance, it sounds like a very boring case. You know, what constitutes a water of the United States? But it's actually a very important case for the reason you mentioned, Chris. It's about reining in regulatory overreach, reining in bureaucratic excess. And I think it's important to understand a little bit of the background of this case, just to understand how egregious, really, the EPA's actions were. The case is Sackett versus the EPA. And basically, the Sacketts, more than 15 years ago, they bought a piece of property in Priest Lake, Idaho, and they wanted to build a home on it. Now, their piece of property, it's not lakefront property. It's not next to the lake. There's no stream connecting the property to the lake. It's, you know, there's a ditch across the street that's connected to some wetlands that connects to a stream that eventually makes its way to the lake. But based on this, the EPA said their property came within the EPA's purview, and they basically couldn't develop it as they wanted to do. And so because of that, the Sackett sued the EPA. It's been a ongoing battle. But thankfully, earlier this week, the Supreme Court released its opinion that basically said, look, the position that the EPA has taken that this property constitutes waters of the United States is absolutely absurd, as it is on its face. Who would imagine dry land could constitute a water of the United States? And so the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, they rejected the EPA's position. They laid down a new test to determine when the EPA could regulate certain areas and entities. And even though the rationale of the decision wasn't unanimous, the outcome was, and that's a big victory, as you mentioned, Chris, for reining in this regulatory overreach.
Zach, I want to ask you about a local case here in Missouri. You know, the trans issue is really big, and, you know, they claim that they are, a lot of them, that they're not getting rights. Apparently, there was a trans individual or binary individual here at a local library that has a goatee but also wears makeup. I'm not sure exactly all of the details of the case, but there are parents, I think, that are protesting outside of this library. Does that person have protection to that job, even though they may look offensive, or patrons of that library may not find him okay?
Well, I'll give a very dissatisfying answer, Chris. I need more information before I give a definitive opinion. But look, here's what I can say. You know, one of the most pernicious decisions from the Supreme Court that's been handed down in recent years is the Bostock versus Clayton County decision that Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote. You know, Justice Gorsuch has been rightly criticized for that decision, where he basically said that under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, sex could also mean sexual orientation or how one presents themselves, whether or not it's in a gender-conforming way or not, and then that could, in fact, be protected activity. Now, never mind that interpretation, I don't think, is supported by the text of that statute. Never mind that when Title VII of the Civil Rights Act was ratified in the 1960s, I am fairly confident that no one ratifying it would have thought that it would protect transgender individuals from cross-dressing and, you know, a whole host of other activities while they were in the workplace. But yet, that's essentially the reading that the Supreme Court has given that piece of legislation. And so I think, you know, many employers find themselves between a rock and a hard place, particularly religious employers who may object to the lifestyle of certain individuals, to the ideals that many of these individuals hold to. And so, you know, we're going to continue to see these types of issues being litigated in the courts for many years to come. But certainly if Congress wanted to, I doubt they will, but if they wanted to, they could certainly act and reverse what I think was the wrong decision in the Bostock case.
Zach, when it comes to this special counsel, Jack Smith, I think, that's investigating President Trump, it seems like with their latest action that it's a complete fishing expedition. Because the president allegedly had documents that he wasn't supposed to have, that the special counsel wants records from 7 different countries to see if the president's actions, maybe he had some type of favorable actions toward those countries, and maybe that was the reason why he doesn't want these documents turned over. I mean, this just sounds like a fishing expedition at this point.
We don't know what Jack Smith has. You know, federal investigations are typically held pretty close to the vest. We don't even really know exactly what theories or what violations of federal law he could be pursuing. You know, there's speculation out there, but we don't really know. Federal investigations are typically held close to the vest, unlike some of the other state investigations out of Georgia and New York, where leaks were coming out ahead of the indictment. That hasn't really happened here with the Jack Smith investigation. But again, what I'll say, Chris, I think what so many people find so problematic about this investigation is the apparent double standard. You know, the Department of Justice is expending massive amounts of time and resources to investigate any potential wrongdoing by President Trump or those in his orbit. And yet we just had the Durham report released not that long ago, last week or the week before, where John Durham laid out systematic failures by the FBI, by the Justice Department, to essentially root out what was fake information being fed to them. And systematic failures is the charitable way of reading the Durham report. Many view it, I think they could rightly view it, as high-ranking FBI officials essentially having it out for Donald Trump and his campaign. Don't forget, you know, Peter Strzok, one of the lead agents in that case, he was exchanging anti-Trump text messages with Lisa Page, another high-ranking FBI lawyer at that time. And then also, when you compare it to the kid glove treatment that rogue U.S. attorney Rachel Rollins has received from the Justice Department, the Office of Inspector General, they said that Rachel Rollins lied to them while they were investigating, you know, some of her many wrongdoing while she was U.S. attorney. That's a federal offense. It's essentially the same federal offense that Michael Flynn was prosecuted for. And yet Merrick Garland's Justice Department, they've declined to move forward prosecuting her, even though OIG says she blatantly lied to them. And so this double standard of justice, that's what's so pernicious, so problematic, and again, really undermines confidence in the rule of law.
Speaking with Zach Smith, legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the podcast SCOTUS 101. Zach, don't fault me for this, but I was channel surfing the other night and I was watching Lawrence O'Donnell. Yes, I apologize for that. And he had
just thinking about it.
I want to get your comment on this. He had a commentary on Chief Justice Roberts, who is Catholic, and Lawrence O'Donnell is Catholic as well. And he had issue with the Chief Justice because he didn't give the answer that he wanted, the thing that he most regretted. Lawrence O'Donnell felt the thing that he most should regret is, quote unquote, this is his words now, signing the death warrant for people that to be executed while the Pope of his church is against executions. And that was just a horrible thing. Is that true that the Chief Justice is the one that signs the death warrant for executions?
Well, no. I know this will shock you. Of course it's not true. And I would also ask Lawrence O'Donnell how he feels about abortion.
Yes.
Because I suspect his position will be vastly different. But look, the Chief Justice, any justice, doesn't sign off on the death warrant. If it's a state case, that's the governor of the state typically. If it's a federal case, that's the president. And all the executive is doing, they're implementing a sentence that's been duly enacted under the laws of either the United States or the state where the person was convicted. Typically, what the justices are reviewing is to see whether there's been a constitutional violation, either in the process of obtaining the conviction, and it's a very lengthy process to get a death penalty conviction and to uphold it on appeal and collateral review. You know, often you see people who were convicted 10, 15, 20 years ago that still have their court cases being heard by multiple levels of courts. And a lot of times what the justices are being asked to decide is whether a particular method of punishment would violate the Constitution. The Eighth Amendment guarantee against cruel and unusual punishment. And as Justice Antonin Scalia, who is also a devout Catholic, used to say, you know, certainly the death penalty itself cannot constitute cruel and unusual punishment. It was, prevalent at the time of our founding. The framers of our Constitution were certainly familiar with it. In fact, if you go all the way back to common law, the death penalty was the penalty for any felony offense. And so it's much more prevalent, much more widespread. And so what Lawrence O'Donnell is essentially asking the Chief Justice to do is to implement his own preferred policy preferences, which again is ironic because I suspect he wouldn't like that on many other issues if the Chief Justice or Clarence Thomas or any of the other justices were to do that. But again, I think it just shows how unserious that commentary about the Supreme Court is and how unserious a lot of commentators are when they talk about the Supreme Court trying to implement a certain policy or a certain goal, because that's not the role of the courts, Chris. The role of the courts is to interpret the law, interpret the Constitution. It's up to our political branches of government to decide what our policies should be.
Zach, let's talk about a serious legal podcast, and that is the SCOTUS 101 podcast that you host with another legal scholar there. What's on this week's episode?
Well, we talk about the Sackett versus EPA case. We also talk about Tyler versus Hennepin County, where Hennepin County, there in Minneapolis, Minnesota, they essentially foreclosed on a 94-year-old woman's condominium because she stopped paying the property taxes. But they might have made a lot of extra money over and above what they were owed when they seized and sold her condo, and they wanted to keep all of it. The justices thankfully said, no, you can't do that. That's a violation of the Fifth Amendment's takings clause. And so we talk about those two cases and other cases as well. There's also a very interesting interview my colleague Giancarlo conducts. And then, of course, we play some Supreme Court trivia at the end of the podcast, where we talk about famous and important Supreme Court cases that were handed down at the end of previous terms.
Zach, I like the Chief Justice John Roberts' comment on that 94-year-old grandmother's case. He said, quote, the taxpayer must render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, but no more. Wow.
That is very true. It's very powerful. And again, that was a unanimous decision by the court. And so I think it really undercuts a lot of the nonsense we've been hearing that this is a deeply divided court, that the court decides issues on ideological lines, when really in most cases, the justices on the court are trying to get the law right. And it often leads to either unanimous decisions or ideological lineups that you wouldn't ordinarily expect.
That is Zach Smith, our legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. You can reach him at tzsmithheritage.org. Is there any other publications you'd like for us to read over the weekend while we're barbecuing, Zach? You have anything?
Well, I hope everyone will consider getting my forthcoming book, Rogue Prosecutors. It's available for pre-order on Amazon now. You can't read it this weekend, but it'll certainly be ready by 4th of July. So I hope everyone will check it out.
Boy, well, guess what we'll be talking about next week, Zach?
Fantastic.
All right, my friend. Have a great weekend. Great talking to you.
Thanks so much. Mm-hmm. Take care.
And when we come back, Katie, I think I will forego Chris's Corner, but we'll talk about this budget deal.
Great.
That is possibly happening, could be signed over the weekend, needs to be signed by at least next Wednesday. Mm-hmm. According to the government's figures, we're going to run out of money. So stay tuned for that. And at 5:07, we'll talk to Mitch Baden, President and Chief Executive Officer at Royal Banks of Missouri. And at 5:24, Dr. Aaron Hudlin, Chief Economist at the Show Me Institute. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Again, the Democrats have backed themselves into a corner here. They've left themselves no other options because they've let their rhetoric get out of hand. They've let it become very extreme. Republicans are smart about this. We said, look, we're going to have demands that are easy to explain to the American people and make sense to the American people. Like you said, 60%+ of the American people think you should probably have some spending controls if you consistently have to raise your own credit limit. And maybe those spending controls should be things like, hey, let's claw back some of the money that's unspent for COVID-era policies. All right, let's maybe not spend $70 billion hiring a bunch of IRS agents. And let's not forgive a bunch of student loans for doctors and lawyers, because that doesn't make sense.
And welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. That is Texas Congressman Dan Crenshaw talking about the budget negotiations. Mm-hmm. All of the talk, and nothing is ever for sure in Washington, of course, but all of the talk is the two sides are very close on a spending budget deal. They say that they have pretty much together when it comes to spending. The two things that they are far apart on is permitting. The Democrats, of course, want permitting for windmills and all of these green energy projects. The Republicans want permitting to drill for oil.
Oh,
so
God.
There's an impasse in there. And one that I don't understand, but the Democrats do not want work requirements for people who are on welfare. If you are an able-bodied person between 18 and 49 years old, they want you to work 25 hours a week. Democrats are adamantly against that, especially the congressional black. Yeah, I hear you, Kate. I don't understand why people aren't up in arms when they hear that here's a major political party that is advocating for people to receive benefits without having to at least do something for them.
Do we know, I'm asking genuinely, do we know why that is the case? Have they laid out, whenever we're talking about mm-hmm. these hearings that are happening, and we see, you know, AOC up there talking about the government, we see Chip Roy up there, and we see Jim... What is the reasoning that the Democrats are giving to say we don't even want people to have to work 25 hours a week?
They really have not given any reasons. I took a quote from a think tank where they came up with some type of numbers that if you require people to work a few hours a week, that 540,000 people somehow are going to lose their benefits. I don't understand the connection of that at all. I don't understand why it's a hard. How does it cut anyone's benefits by having to clean up trash on the side of the road, volunteer somewhere, do something? I mean,
purpose.
Exactly.
I'm not saying the other part about all of this is that some people work until they're in their grave. I mean, some people are workaholics, and we have as a culture promoted this idea where you have to like work 60 or 70 hours a week to maintain. That I also don't agree with. But if you're trying to sell me on the idea that people don't need to have a drive and a purpose in this world that motivates them to make their next goal, to make more money, to... then what's the point?
I mean, I can remember when my parents owned a beauty supply business. They had 5 stores at that time. And I can remember being 10 or 11 years old, and they made me go into the stores and work 40 hours a week during the summer. And I hated it. I wanted to be at home playing with my friends and getting in trouble and doing the things that kids do. But it felt really good at, every 2 weeks when I got that paycheck and signed the back of it, and they cashed it, and I had like cash, and I felt good saying, wow, I earned some money and there's taxes being taken out. I feel responsible.
It is. It is. And it's a world in which you are bettering yourself to be better for maybe your family, maybe for the environment, maybe for your community. But a job gives you stability in all aspects of your life. If you can control, again, not saying you have to work 70 hours a week, but to tell people that they literally don't need to have a job, period, and you can sit on your butt all day and hang out, what is that going to do to our economy as a whole?
And what does that say to Black people when the Congressional Black Caucus, that's something that they are fighting for tooth and nail with this deal, that Black people that are poor should not have to work for benefits. It just amazes me that in this time period that people aren't just up in arms, or a political party is not ashamed to even support that policy. A group is not ashamed of that. It's astounding to me. Steve has a comment. Yeah. Steve, how are you?
Hello?
Hi, Steve.
Oh, there you are. Okay. So, this being Memorial Day weekend, the speaker had asked me to make a phone call whenever I'm getting ready to do this. And, of course, he's not there. Probably enjoying his vacation right now. But every year for Memorial Day, my wife, my son, and I put up right around 1,000 flags every year.
It's incredible.
It's been on the news a couple of times, so I think, Katie, you've seen pictures, haven't you, Katie?
Yeah, Steve has been with us for a long time, and Steve, you and Chris have talked many times, too.
Yes.
It's something, it's a tradition for Steve and for his family, and I've seen pictures. It's beautiful.
Where do you put them up, Steve?
In my front yard.
Okay, 1,000?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
It's gorgeous.
Actually, I could tell you where it's at.
Well, don't do that.
Not on the air.
Okay.
Not on the air. But the speaker lives very close to my house. A former colleague of yours, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
He knows exactly where it's at.
Okay. Well, send us some pictures then, because
he's in my neighborhood area. So.
Okay. Well, don't give that away.
Yeah. Well,
we're good.
Send us some pictures then. I'd love to see them. Katie can put them on the website.
Yeah.
And show that. I'm like, we don't want to show your house, and since we're kind of giving it away, but we'll figure something out.
Yeah, send them to info@newstalkstl, okay, Steve? info@newstalkstl.com.
Chris, it's been on the news, so the news has already put it out.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve. So, have a great holiday.
Sure thing. Have a safe holiday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Chris, when it comes to specifically what these congressmen and women are fighting for the Black community, is that, I know the answer, but I want you, what is that super offensive when they think demographically this is the most appealing thing that we can tell Black Americans? You don't have to achieve really anything. You can hang out.
I think it's twofold. I think they do adhere to that philosophy, but I think the Congressional Black Caucus, the NAACP, the Urban League, a lot of these groups are so aligned with the Democratic Party that whatever they want, talking points they put out, whatever they want to promote, they can rest assured that these groups are behind them sponsoring it or supporting it, and they give them cover. I mean, the Democrats at whole, they don't want people to work. They want to keep people lazy. But if they can have the Congressional Black Caucus and Black people saying that this is horrible, this is racist, then it gives them cover, and people won't criticize it as much because it's the Congressional Black Caucus. But they basically just do the dirty work.
of the Congressional Black Caucus of the Democratic Party. I said this the other day, they have basically bought and sold the black preachers that on a Sunday before an election, they'll have the Democrat politicians in there practically giving partisan speeches. The clergy, it's the same. You know, they were smart. The Democratic Party was a long, long time ago that if you want to have great influence within the black community, it starts with the preachers. And it even goes farther back than that because Margaret Sanger, the person that founded Planned Parenthood, that's what she said. She has a famous saying where we don't want black people thinking that we're out to kill them, and we can hire 3 or 4 engaging colored ministers out there to dispel that truth that happens. And that has just fostered down in the Democratic Party. That's who they go
to. That's evil to me.
It is evil.
Like, that's evil to use people's faith in and their trustworthiness in the person that's supposed to be a shepherd to their faith in a way to manipulate politics. That is evil to me.
Well, it's, you know, preachers are just like any other human being. Some people love being close to power and politicians and people that love power, and you show them a little favor in that sense and they sell out their principles. And I think that has happened within the civil rights movement a long, long time ago. You watch any NAACP convention during an election year, Republican president, if they do go show up, it's a very muted response. Very muted clapping, if they clap at all. A Democrat goes there, it's a convention. it's a whole different affair. And I've always said it, and I've said this till I'm blue in the face, and that's physically impossible. But I don't understand why African Americans, my fellow African Americans, don't see that we would have so much more leverage if we had both of the parties fighting for our vote instead of one knowing that they have it and the other one not fighting for it because they know they'll never get it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the way the market works. Yeah. I mean, that is like that's the way that people look at the economy.
Black vote could literally be a vote that swings elections.
Yes.
Literally. And African Americans are stuck in a 60s paradigm where they think their political power is voting as a group for the Democratic Party instead of having both of the parties support or fighting for our vote. Mm-hmm. And it's just an old 60s paradigm. That time frame has passed us by. It was necessary at one time to be in one party because the other party really didn't want your vote. But now both parties want it. Leverage that.
I agree.
I don't understand why we don't do that. But that's a subject for another day. When we come back, we'll speak with Mitch Baden. He's president and chief executive officer at Royal Banks of Missouri. We'll also speak with Dr. Aaron Hudlin at 524. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Sarp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.